This is Biblical Wisdom, an online Bible study with Dr. John Collins.
Okay, good evening, everyone. There was once a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job. How many of you know where the land of Uz is? If you say you do, you're bluffing, because nobody does. It probably isn't any such place, actually. It might as well have been the land of Oz. It's kind of, once upon a time, there was a man named Job. Even the rabbis in antiquity knew that this wasn't to be taken quite literally. And they said that Job is a parable. Well, whether you regard him as a parable or not, the point is, you know, he's a fictitious case. The remarkable thing, though, is wherever the land of Uz is, it's not in Israel, and it's not in the Jewish diaspora. And therefore, you know, it's quite exceptional in the Hebrew Bible. And for that reason, some people thought this must belong back before Abraham, back kind of in prehistoric times. In fact, you know, there is no consensus as to when this book was written. And estimates of it have ranged anywhere from the time of the Babylonian exile all the way down to the Hellenistic period. Now, I think probably the best handle we have on that is the language. And the language of the book is made up of a folk tale at the beginning and the end, and then long poetic dialogues in the middle. And the assumption is that the folk tale is the older part, and that then somebody expanded it. So somebody with some real literary talent wrote these dialogues and filled out the story. Now, it's that the poetry, as that the language of it, is somewhat similar to what we find in the second half of the book of Isaiah, which comes from around the time of the Babylonian exile. And so I would think that's probably our best guess as to when it comes from. But in truth, we don't know. It's not a very late book, and it's not a very early book, I would think. I think it presupposes, at least it presupposes some form of Proverbs, or at least of that tradition, which we were talking about in the first lecture. I don't think it's as late as the book of Koheleth. Now, as I say, you have a story at the beginning, and then it's elaborated in the poetic dialogues. So the story goes, there was a man whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. As we saw already, you know, fearing God is the quintessence of wisdom. And the assumption is that if you fear God and, you know, mind your P's and Q's, you will prosper. And so there were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters, which I guess they thought was more or less the right proportion. He also had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys. So this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. The assumption is you're a good person, therefore you do well. And his sons used to go and feast in one another's houses, and they generally had a great time. And Job was so righteous that he would even offer sacrifice just in case they got carried away some night and did something inappropriate. So he was taking no chances whatsoever. And then one day, the heavenly beings, it says in the NRSV, it's the sons of God, came to present themselves before the Lord. Who are the sons of God? Well, at no point in antiquity did people think that God was up there all alone. In later tradition, we'd call these people angels. At the time when the book of Job was written, they weren't yet classified as angels. They were regarded as gods. You know, sons of God, lesser gods. So not the Most High, but nonetheless divine beings. And Satan also came among them. Now, Satan is only mentioned about three times in the Hebrew Bible. One of them is in the book of Zechariah, which was written right after the Babylonian exile, when he brings accusations against the high priest. So he's a muckraker, troublemaker, tester. And he's mentioned in Chronicles when he incites David to take a census of Israel, which turns out to be very unpopular. So he also shows up in the book of Numbers in the Balaam story. But he is an adversary, is more or less what the word means. You could think of him as a kind of prosecuting attorney. What you cannot think of him as at this point in time is the devil. The devil has not yet been invented. So Satan is a member of the heavenly council in good standing. He is the prosecuting attorney, something, somebody who looks for dirt on people and brings accusations against them. But this is a job in the heavenly court. He has not yet been kicked downstairs. That would happen sometime in the early Hellenistic period, which is to say between 300 and 100, say, BCE. When we get to the Book of Wisdom in the last lecture of this course, we will find reference to the devil. And by then, they have a concept of the devil as the prince of evil, you know, who abides in the nether regions. But he isn't that yet. Here, he is just somebody who has a job to do in the divine court, which is to test people. So he comes along to the Lord, and the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man." And Satan says to the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands. Why wouldn't he fear you? Why wouldn't he revere you? He's getting well paid for it." Now, interestingly enough, you get the same kind of argument in Plato's Republic, where Socrates says, if you want to know whether somebody is really good, is truly good, then you have to get a case of somebody who not only doesn't gain anything by being good, but doesn't even have the reputation of it, has the reputation of not being good, and see, does the person persist in those conditions? And it's more or less a similar setup. I'm not suggesting that there was any influence here. I don't think the Book of Job knew Plato or vice versa. But it's the same idea, the idea that real goodness has to be disinterested and you can't be making a profit from it on the side. So the Lord said to Satan, "Very well, he is in your power." Now, you know, observe as you go through this book the character of the Lord. The Lord disposes of Job and his family quite lightly, quite easily. Note also that as a reader, you are being told up front what is going to happen here. So what happens? One day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking, a messenger came to Job and said, you know, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, etc. And, you know, there was a raid and they all got killed. And all of this happens. He has one really bad day. And pretty much his whole family gets wiped out. And when all of this happens, Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head and fell on the ground, said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And this is counted as perfect behavior. But then Satan comes back. The Lord says, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth. He still persists in his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason. And take note of that. This is God's own admission. Why did God inflict all these things on Job? Basically, for no reason. Just to see how he would take it. Robert Frost has a great play on Job, A Mask of Reason, in which he says, God say, I was just showing off to the devil. Now, that's being a little anachronistic about Satan, but that's how it is. No reason whatsoever, and you're told this up front. So is Satan impressed? He says, well, no, actually. Because skin for skin, all that people have, they will give to save their lives. You haven't touched him at all yet. Killing all his family isn't going to do it. So the Lord says to Satan, very well, he's in your power. Only spare his life. Because if you don't spare his life, you lose the experiment. You know, you need to keep him alive to see how he's going to take it. This is kind of chilling. If you think about it. And so Satan went out and inflicted sores on Job, and Job took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die and get it over with. But then, and still Job did not sin with his lips. What cracks Job eventually is three friends heard of all his troubles and come to sympathize with him. And when they see him, they sit at a distance and start to wail. And this apparently finally breaks Job down, because then he starts talking in chapter 3 and he's going to go on for over 30 chapters. He may not quite curse God, but he curses the day he was born, which is coming pretty close. And he says some pretty harsh things about God along the way. So what exactly, what he says is obvious enough. He's just complaining, why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? And then the first of the friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, answered, if one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? Now, you know, if you read through this book as a piece of literature, it's nicely done. The friends begin quite politely, and then they become less and less patient with Job, and the whole tone of the exchange changes by the time you get into the middle of the book. But, says Eliphaz, think now, who that was innocent ever perished, or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God, they perish. So that's his explanation. He said, who that was innocent ever perished. And in chapter 5, verse 8, as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause. So, in effect, the advice to Job is, Job, you must have done something. So, you need to come clean with God, make a confession, and then God will be merciful and restore you. That's the recipe. Job will not have that at all. In chapter 6, verse 24, he says, teach me and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone wrong. Now, there you get one of the crucial points in the book, because the friends are saying, you must have done something wrong. This is deductive reasoning. They say, it has to be this way. We know how the world works. You can infer it. And Job says you can't infer anything. If you have evidence that I actually did something wrong, tell me what it is. My companions are treacherous like a torrent bed because he feels that they have betrayed him by assuming that he has done something wrong. So says Job in chapter 7, verse 11, therefore I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the dragon that you set a guard over me? Now, that's an allusion to a common ancient mythology that there was a dragon in the sea who was the opponent of God, who was the agent of chaos, so to speak. And God has to keep this dragon under control. But says Job, I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are a breath. And he says, in effect, he says to God, just let me die and get it over with. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered, how long will you say these things, and the words of your word be a great wind? Does God pervert justice? And now this is one of the basic questions of the book that we need to come back to at the end of it. Does God pervert justice? Would God let all of this happen to Job if Job or his children hadn't sinned against him? If your children sinned against him, he delivered them into the power of their transgression. If you seek God and make supplication, he says he will fix you. Can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? Do you remember in the first lecture of this class, I talked about the chain of act and consequence. No smoke without a fire. And equally, papyrus cannot grow where there is no marsh, and reeds cannot flourish where there is no water. So they say, he says, you must have. Now, Job says in chapter 9, indeed I know that this is so, but how can a mortal be just before God? So, in effect, he says, God could always, if you have an argument with God, you can't win. The deck is stacked. In 9:20, though I am innocent, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I do not know myself. I loathe my life. It is all one, therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. Now, think about that for a minute. Is this in accordance with your theology? Is this your view of God? That he mocks at the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the eyes of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it? Look around in the world. Does justice prevail? It would be hard to say that it does, or indeed that it ever did. And says Job, if God isn't responsible for that, who is? Where does the buck stop? Remember that, because at the end of the book, the question will come up, who has spoken rightly about God? In chapter 13, and skipping along here, you know, the book is, if we may be pardoned for saying so, a bit long-winded. So much so that the Greek translators cut it by about one third, without any noticeable loss of meaning. You know, but it's the nature of Hebrew poetry that it's very repetitive, that you say the same thing over and over again. But every now and then you hit on a patch of clarity in it. In chapter 13, Look, he says, my eye has seen all this. My eye, ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. Job has many virtues. Modesty isn't necessarily one of them. But I would speak to the Almighty. Now, this is, I desire to argue my case with God. And this is often held up, you know, as kind of the quintessence of Job, that he wants to argue his case with God. You know, it's if I may say so, it's a very Jewish thing. You know, there's an old tradition of this. It goes back to Abraham arguing about the face of Sodom and Gomorrah, that you can argue with God in that tradition. As for you, you whitewash with lies, you are worthless physicians. If you would only keep silent, that would be your wisdom. Hear now my reasoning and listen to the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? What does it mean to speak falsely for God? Will you show partiality towards him? Will you plead the case for God? In theological language, this is called apologetics, to plead the case for God, to defend God. And Job says, what business do you have defending God? But more particularly, he says, will you lie for God? Now, there was a story in this morning's New York Times about a certain Christian university which had been covering up crime on the campus, and I think largely sexual crime on the campus. You know, because, I mean, you can't have that. You can't admit that that's going on at a Christian university. But that Christian university isn't all that exceptional. This has happened in all the churches. I think this has been at the root of the cover-up, you know, of the whole pedophile crisis. That people, you know, don't want the church to look bad and don't want God to look bad. And they consider that to be virtuous. Now, says Job, no way. That's lying for God. The first responsibility of anybody is to call it as you see it, to be honest about it. And that's the first point in his quarrel with his friends, I think. That they are lying for God, and he says, it will not be good for you when he seeks you out. Now, I'm skipping over here a lot of rather good poetry. My eye falls here in chapter 14. A mortal born of woman, few of days and full of trouble. You know, that there are some great depictions of human life as nasty, brutish, and short in these chapters. You know, the great articulation of human suffering. But I'll skip ahead, because even though they go back and forth, the argument doesn't really advance beyond what I've summarized. In chapter 19, verse 25, I will just mention in passing, because it's a famous passage. Oh, that my words were written down. Oh, this is Job speaking. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and with lead they were engraved on a rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand forth on the earth. And this, of course, has become a favorite text, thanks to Handel, if nothing else. You know, I know that my Redeemer liveth, almost as a messianic prophecy. But I don't think it was that at all, actually. I think what Job was saying is, I know that I'm right. And I know that sooner or later, this will come out. I think that's all he's saying. There isn't any messianic hope in Job, and there isn't any hope for a resurrection or vindication in an afterlife. What he wants is vindication in this world. Eventually, it may take time, but eventually, he says, it will come out. Another passage that kind of requires some parenthetical comment is chapter 28. Most of the middle part of the book of Job consists of dialogues. It's a running argument. Chapter 28 is a poem that kind of stands back from everything, like a Greek chorus. It's kind of a meta commentary on the rest of the book. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold to be refined and all of that. But it says, where in verse 12, where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Mortals do not know the way to it. It is not found in the land of the living. Now, this is quite at odds with the book of Proverbs. In the book of Proverbs, you were told that wisdom goes out and cries in the street and goes looking for people and is not hard to find. Job says it's human beings just can't find it. And in fact, then God finally in verse 23 says God understands the way to it and he knows its place. But as I mentioned when we were talking about Proverbs, I think the assumption here is that wisdom is not something created by God. Wisdom is something that is somewhere inherent in the world. God knows the way to it. That's what makes God special, if you like. But wisdom is something independent of God. And wisdom is, I think, in all of this tradition, wisdom is a kind of divine presence in the world. It's a different way of thinking about the divine rather than thinking in terms of an anthropomorphic deity. It's something that you can acquire, that you can get into you, you can participate in, rather than, a king or a judge that you have to obey and relate to as an external force. God understands the way to it. When he gave the wind its weight and apportioned out the waters by measure, then he saw it and declared it. And he said to humankind, truly the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Now, what I think it's saying there is God really knows wisdom. And God tells humanity, for you, wisdom is obeying me. So it's not telling human beings how to really find wisdom. It's telling them that wisdom for them is to fear the Lord, to acquiesce, to submit, and to obey. And in a way, this is preparing the way for what we'll find now in the last couple of books in the wisdom tradition, where they bring the law into the picture. You don't yet get any talk about the law or the Torah or Moses or any of that stuff in Job. But in a way, it's preparing the way for it because it's saying God, sets limits to human beings and tells them what is wisdom for them, which isn't quite the same thing as what is wisdom in any absolute sense. After that hymn in the book of Job, there is an interlude where Job protests his innocence. And he says, oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent. So he's saying, I wish things were the way they used to be before all of this happened to him. And, as Job tells it, it was a deal. It was a covenant, if you like, between himself and God. And he kept his end of it, as he thinks. When I went out to the gate of the city and took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood up. The nobles refrained from talking. They lay their hands on their mouths. The voices of the princes were hushed. Their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. because I delivered the poor who cried and the orphan who had needed a helper. And, you know, as he tells it, he appears indeed to be a good person, an agent for good. But part of the deal is that he gets respect and he gets rewarded for it. You know, that it's a bargain. And there are two sides to the bargain. But now, he says in chapter 30, now they make sport of me, those who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to sit with the dogs of my flock. I think that tells you maybe something about Job too, that he may have been a righteous person, but he knew it. You know, he felt that he had certain rights, that he had certain things coming to him, so to speak. And he certainly felt that not all people were on a par with him. Now they mock me in song, and I am a byword to him. And that, in part, I think, is what galls him, is the loss of status and the loss of respect. I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I look upon a virgin? What would be my portion with God above? And he goes on to say, look, if I ever did anything wrong with somebody else's wife, take my wife and do something with her. But, you know, the irony of all of this passage is that he really isn't in a position to be declaring terms to God. He isn't really in a position to be telling God what would be appropriate for him in this situation. But there is then another interlude in which Elihu enters and tries to do a better job than the friends had done. And most people feel he doesn't do any better than they did. But he gives it a shot. But the crunch of the book comes in chapter 38, when the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Now, he goes, I mean, that's the argument, actually, in a nutshell. You know, do people have rights in this world? Do creatures have rights? The delicate subject of whether the Bible supports human rights. There's a sense in which it does, but in a theological sense, it's not really human rights. You know, it has concepts of right and wrong that might be translated into human rights. But from the perspective of this poem, I think, creatures don't have rights. Where were we when God laid the foundation of the earth? He goes on to talk about commanding the morning, and engrave the springs in the sea, and on the whole paints a rather positive creation, a rather positive picture of the world. We'll meet next day in the book of Sirach a poem somewhat like this that paints a more ambivalent picture of the world because, well, you know, if you look at nature, there are wonderful things about nature, but there are awfully destructive things in nature too. You know, you have the hurricanes and the tornadoes and all the forces of nature that just bring death and destruction. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? I think I may have mentioned to you, we were watching the prequel to the movies, the television series Yellowstone. that the first prequel was 1883. And it's narrated by a young woman, and it was kind of discovering the West. And at some point she says, how could God make the flowers so beautiful and then have poisonous snakes hiding under them? And she says, then it hit me. He didn't make it for us. Now, I don't know how far they follow through on that insight in that series. I think it's a hard insight to swallow because, you know, all of human civilization has been based on the premise that God did make the world for us. And indeed, you get that impression from the opening chapters of Genesis. Or perhaps you can get it that way. But you don't get that impression from Job. No, what God says to Job is, you're complaining about what happened to you. I've got bigger things on my mind. What about the mountain goats? What about the young lions who are hungry? That there is a whole ecosystem out there that has to be catered for. And, you know, if he were aware of other planets and God knows what, the whole picture could become a whole lot more complicated. Who ever said that all of this was for humanity or was calibrated to work for the benefit of humanity? So that, in effect, is his response to Job. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars and spreads its wings towards the south? Now, does God pervert justice? What is justice? Is God accountable to our ideas of justice? I mean, that's a tough question because one would hope that our ideas of justice are in tune with God's idea of justice, but it doesn't always seem so. And what Job is saying here is that you don't really have any right to hold God to account. So Job answered the Lord in 40 verse 3, see, I am of small account. How shall I answer you? He had, mind you, predicted that that's what he would have to say. I have spoken once, I will not answer, twice, but I will proceed no further. And then the Lord answered Job, gird up your loins like a man. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? And again, rather than arguing about whether he's justified or not, he says, have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? That comes down to power. And so finally in 42, Job answered the Lord, I know that you can do all things, that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Then I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. The translation of that passage has been very controversial and it is difficult, but I think that the sense of it is surely clear enough that it is abject surrender on the part of Job. He says, I give up. You have all the cards in this. I can't argue with you. I submit. And then you turn to the prose prologue, the prose conclusion, epilogue. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now, what had they said about God? They had said, God does not pervert justice. And Job had said, he does. That he laughs at the despair of the innocent. that he covers the earth with injustice, and if it isn't he, who does it? And now God says to the friends, you know, Job was honest. Job, you know, was direct about it. You guys were covering up. And therefore, he tells them, go and ask my servant Job to pray for you. And then the Lord restored the fortunes of Job, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And then there came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him and showed sympathy, and each of them gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. If you were Job, would you be impressed? Where had these people been? Now they come out of the woodwork when Job is restored. And if he is restored at the end, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters again. Now, does that mean then everything is fine? Everything was covered over? You know, if you had 7 sons and 3 daughters who were wiped out in the first case, would you feel okay if you got 7 other sons and 3 other daughters in replacement? You know, it's not quite the same thing. And has Job, would you think, learned anything from this whole experience? And I would think he ought to have. Because at the beginning of the book, or as he looks back on how he had been before all of this, he says, you know, that he felt he had an agreement with God, and that if he behaved in a certain way, God would behave in a certain way to him. And he ought to have learned by now that you can't count on that. You know, all it would take would be one bad day to wipe out the whole thing again. So I think it's quite a sobering book in that way. This is not a warm and cuddly God by any means. You know, this is a God who is extremely powerful, concerned with the whole of creation, and humanity is by no means the highest priority in it. In the end, why had he put Job through all of this? Well, as he puts it himself, it was just on a dare from Satan. As casually as that. But it's also saying, you know, that God doesn't owe us anything. And what are you going to do about it? What do you think? You know, this is very, very different from what we had in Proverbs. Proverbs, you know, was based on trust in the universe, that everything works, that there's a natural order that works. And this is saying the world is run by an inscrutable God who can do things on whim. Now, you know, the God of Job also does a lot of things well, as he recites in the last couple of chapters. The morning stars sing with joy, and the mountain goats and the hungry lions all get somehow taken care of. Sort of. But at the same time, you know, there is no promise in Job that good behavior leads to good experience, or that there is a reward for anything in this life, or indeed, and Job doesn't really allow for any kind of a reward in the hereafter.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 5.